you are standing at the precipice of both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say Black Lives Matter rather than All Lives Matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing progressive speakers to campuses and communities across the United States. If you enjoy the program, consider becoming a monthly patron to help us expand our reach and impact. For as little as $2 a month, you can gain access to special bonus audio commentaries unavailable anywhere else, as well as signed books and DVDs, among other goodies. And every donation is tax deductible, as it goes to Speak Out and help support their educational and activist mission. If you're interested, head over to www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise and help support progressive podcasting today. My guest on the program today is Manifa Bendele, Vice President and Chief Partnership and Equity Officer for Moms Rising, an organization committed to bringing the voices and real-world experiences of women and mothers straight to our local, state, and national leaders, as well as to amplify women's voices within the national public policy dialogue and in the media. Manifa has more than a decade of experience in policy analysis, communications, civic engagement organizing, and project management, working with groups like the Brennan Center for Justice, People's Hurricane Relief Fund, and the National Coalition on Black Civic Participation. At Moms Rising, she manages the Food Justice Campaign, helping to successfully increase children's access to healthy food and working to stem junk food marketing. Forbes has named MomsRising.org one of the top websites for women 4 years in a row. During her tenure at the Brennan Center as National Field Director for the Right to Vote campaign, the coalition successfully changed laws in 5 states, expanding the franchise to more than 250,000 formerly incarcerated people. Today, we'll be focusing on the efforts of Moms Rising to address maternal health disparities between black and white women in America, including distressing rates of maternal mortality for African American women irrespective of their socioeconomic status, a persistent problem that largely explains why maternal death rates are so much higher in the United States than in the rest of the developed world. My conversation with Manifa Bendele after this week's commentary. So as is often the case, lots of disturbing stories in the news in the past week to week and a half that, as always, speak to the way in which whiteness and white supremacy and white privilege and institutional and interpersonal racism continue to operate. Of course, we had the incident at the Philadelphia Starbucks where two men who were there waiting to meet with a friend of theirs or a colleague of theirs after being in the Starbucks for only 2 minutes, but not having bought anything, were asked to leave and then had the police called on them for presumptive trespassing. The police show up, take them out, don't speak to the manager, don't try to clear anything up. They just go, they put the cuffs on, they lead them out. These two young men end up in custody for 8 hours. Ultimately, of course, charges are dropped. We've all heard about the story. Very disturbing example of how black folks are presumed simply not to belong, even in a place that most of us have gone to probably several times, not necessarily looking to buy anything right away, maybe going to meet a friend, going to have a chat with somebody, or just going to get online, do some work, and maybe eventually buy something, of course, but not necessarily within the first 2 minutes. I've certainly gone into several Starbucks and used the bathroom. I travel oftentimes around the country by car, and oftentimes will stop to get coffee, but before I get the coffee, I go to the bathroom. I've done it at least a dozen times, and no one has ever asked me anything or said anything to me.
On some occasions, I've gone in and have walked right out without buying anything. No one has ever said, hey, wait a minute, you need to buy something. Never has that happened, nor do I think it would at any Starbucks anywhere in the country or most any other establishment. Of course, there are those who heard the story and even saw the video, which was taken by a white customer. There were white customers who served as witnesses in this particular case and have all attested to the fact that the two black men in question did absolutely nothing wrong. They did not act in an aggressive or impolite manner. They were nothing but polite. If anything, one of those white witnesses who I heard Toure interviewed her on his podcast said, look, we were the ones who were being aggressive. We were the ones who were mouthing off at the cops. It wasn't the black guys. But there are still these folks who refuse to believe it, who have been accusing even those white witnesses, let alone the black guys themselves, of exaggerating the problem, of playing a race card, of being race traitors, even. The woman who Toure had on his show, that's what she said. She's been called by people on social media a race traitor just for talking about an incident of anti-black racism. It's as if being white and saying anything about that in the eyes of some, puts you on an anti-white team somehow. Simply calling out racist behavior on the part of white people somehow makes you anti-white. It's a fascinating look into white racist psychology. Others have accused the witnesses, and we've all had this experience, accuse us not necessarily of being traitors for speaking out, but certainly being race baiters. So in other words, the actual mistreatment isn't the problem. It's speaking about the mistreatment that's the problem. It's talking about it, you know. So there's that incident. We've all heard about it. Starbucks has said they're going to, do training. And, training's fine if there are no accountability measures, however, if there's no actual set of policies, practices, and procedures that we hope will come out of the training and that we're going to expect Starbucks to implement, and then some accountability tools that we can use to actually see if they're doing a better job, then I'm not really sure what good the training is going to do. So we'll see. We'll see how that works. But there was another story in the news around the same time on the 13th of April is when I read about it. So I guess it happened, that week. There was another story which also speaks to the way in which so oftentimes black people are presumed out of place. And this one didn't get nearly as much attention, but there was this story out of Michigan. You may or may not have heard about it. A retired Detroit firefighter, white guy, was charged with assault with intent to murder after he shot at a 14-year-old black kid who knocked on his door to ask for directions to get to school. Apparently, this young man, whose name is Brennan Walker of Rochester Hills, Michigan, woke up on this particular day, and I guess he'd missed the bus to get to school, so it was a four-mile walk. But, he hasn't walked the route before, and so he gets lost. As just a side note, before I tell you the rest of the story, no, this is a young black man who was willing to walk 4 miles to get to school. And we always hear about how black youth don't value education enough, how black families don't value education enough. Apparently, this kid valued it so much that even having overslept and missed the bus or whatever it was, that he was willing to walk. I don't know that I would have, frankly, been willing to walk 4 miles to get to school. I used to take any excuse that I could not to go to school. And I lived, at least when it came to my high school, same age that this kid, I lived probably, maybe 400 yards from the high school. And man, if I could figure a way not to go, I would do it. But so this young man is trying to find his way to school. As I said, he gets lost and he decides he's going to ask for directions. And so he approaches this home and he says he gets there. He knocks on the door and this lady, he says, this white woman from behind the door starts yelling and says something along the lines of, why are you trying to break into my house? And this kid says he was trying to get directions to Rochester High, and she keeps yelling at him. And then this guy comes down, it's her husband, grabs the gun. The kid sees it, he starts to run, and that's when he hears this gunshot. And so this guy, Jeff Ziegler is his name, 53 years old, chases Walker into the yard, fires a 12-gauge shotgun at the fleeing teenager, which is incredibly lucky that he was not killed because, the 12-gauge shotgun, you don't have to have real good aim. Pellets go everywhere, and so it's really quite lucky that he wasn't hit. Apparently, the homeowner missed because the gun's safety lock was still in place, and then he got this other round, second round off after he disengaged the safety. Luckily, the young man was not injured, and then Ziegler, the guy that shot, he and his wife call 911. They claim that Walker was trying to break into the house, but ultimately, of course, the police determine, thankfully, that was not the case. Apparently, this woman also said something along the lines as her husband was getting the gun, you know, why did they pick our house or something like that? You know, why did they pick our house? It's one kid. He picked your house because it looked like a house he could get directions from. But when you say, why did they choose us? You know, it's as if you think there's this whole gang of roving black teenagers who are just coming to steal your shit and assault you, or maybe murder you in your bed. I mean, it's a deep, deep, deep pathology, a deep, deep-seated white supremacist mindset that infects this man who pulled this gun. I hope he is adjudicated guilty, and I hope he is put away for a significant period of time. I believe in restorative justice. I'm not a big fan of imprisoning anyone, but the reality is restorative justice requires that the perpetrator of the misdeed be willing to own their misconduct, be willing to acknowledge it and make amends to those they have harmed. This guy doesn't show any indication of even being willing to own that he did anything wrong. In any event, what we can say about this, again, is that there's a presumption of non-belonging. We certainly see that in the immigration debate, right, where Latinx folks who have been in the country for three generations, it's not even a question of whether they're documented or undocumented. They're citizens of this country. They were born here. Their parents were born here. Their grandparents were born here. But merely because they are brown skin and have, quote unquote, Hispanic surnames, they are being questioned as to where they come from. They're, you know, we're hearing incidents all around the country of brown folk being told, go back to your country. And like, they're in their country. If you're a person of color and you speak with any kind of an accent, right, there's a presumption that you don't belong. On the other hand, there are plenty of white folks speaking with accents who are presumed to belong. Melania Trump has an accent. Nobody's questioning her belonging. Ivana Trump has an accent. That's Ivanka's mother, just so we're clear on that. I'm not talking about Ivanka, but Ivana has an accent. Henry Kissinger hadn't lost that damn accent. He's been in this country for how long? 60-something, 70 years, right? His accent is still there, but you can be of European descent and speak with an accent. Nobody's going to question your sense of belonging. But if you're Asian American, Pacific Islander, Latinx, from the Caribbean, anywhere really other than Europe, and you speak with an accent, you're presumed not to belong. And it all reminded me, this particular story out of Michigan, it reminded me of something that I hadn't written about or talked about for a long time. I did write about it in the first version of White Like Me, my memoir, which was written back in 2005. I took it out in subsequent editions and put different stories in that I thought made the point better. But maybe I shouldn't have done that because it is a relevant story. I wrote about it and I've talked about it a few times. So this was in 2003, and I had been invited to give a talk for MLK Day, or it was sometime during the MLK holiday week in Moscow, Idaho. I think it's pronounced Moscow. It may be Moscow, but I'm sorry to those who were listening from there. If I'm pronouncing it wrong, I apologize. It's been a minute since I was there. But back in 2003, I was invited to give a talk there for MLK, and I flew into Spokane and got a rental car and, you know, was going throughout eastern Washington to get over the border into Idaho. And I was driving as the sun was going down. It was starting to get dark. By the time I got sort of close to where I needed to be, it was dark. And this is before GPS. This is before smartphones. You know, I didn't have a Garmin, even an old school GPS in the car. I don't think they had those yet. Or if they did, I didn't have one in the car that I was driving. So all I was relying on were just sort of these handwritten directions on how to get to the place I was going. I was going to a reception, like a dinner that was being held by the committee, the MLK Day committee, the night before the event. And I'm totally lost. The fog has rolled in, as it often does in that part of eastern Washington and Idaho. And so I really didn't know where I was going. I did have a cell phone. The battery was dying, though. I think I was maybe at like, would have been like 2%. I don't even know if the old school flip phones gave you a percentage, but whatever it was very, very, very low. The little battery icon showed that I was in pretty bad trouble as far as cell battery power was concerned. So I'm trying to figure out what I'm going to do and how I'm going to find my way to this place because it's dark and it's foggy and it's rural. And, you know, I thought, well, I could pull over and make a phone call and I guess I could try it that way. But again, the phone's about to die. Finally, my phone rings and it is one of the organizers of the event and they give me instructions. I let them know where I am, sort of some of the landmarks or the signs that I was seeing, and they figured it out and they got me where I was trying to go. No problem. But afterward, you know, I was thinking about this and I was thinking, what happens if I don't have a cell phone? Because I had just gotten one maybe 6 months before. This was early 2003. I did not have a cell phone until the latter part of 2002, the latter half of 2002. So what if I hadn't had a cell phone? A lot of people didn't in the early 2000s, as hard as that is to believe now. Or what if that cell phone had in fact gone dead and I didn't have a cord clearly to plug it in the car? What if, you know, what if the cell phone's not working? What if the cell service is just shitty and the reception's bad, which I have no doubt in that part of the country at that time, the coverage probably wasn't all that great. It's pretty remote. What am I going to do? And I realized that what I probably would have done is I would probably have pulled into someone's driveway and I would have walked up to their door and I would have knocked or I would have rung the doorbell and I would have asked for directions. And the fact is, I would have done that in spite of the fact that it was dark and in spite of the fact that I would be a stranger, you know, coming up to someone's door. It never would have occurred to me. It did in retrospect as I'm thinking about it, right? But it never would have at the time. Had I needed directions, I would not have hesitated to go up to some stranger's door, figuring that if I explain what's going on, they'll probably let me know where I need to go and where I made the wrong turn. And they'll be nothing but polite. They might offer me juice or something. I don't know. And then I got to thinking, what would have happened if instead of me being the MLK speaker for Moscow, Idaho in January of 2003, what if the committee had invited a black speaker for that talk? Wouldn't have been outside of the ordinary. After all, most MLK Day speakers around the country, I figure, probably are most certainly black. So what if the person they invited that year had in fact been an African-American activist, writer, author, educator? And what if that black MLK Day speaker had flown into Spokane and gotten a rental car and driven the route through eastern Washington, heading toward Pullman and then across the border into Idaho to find this reception place to have dinner and gotten lost just like I did? Because just like me, they wouldn't have known the proper route. They wouldn't have been familiar with the area. The fog is rolling in. Their cell phone is dying or maybe dead or maybe they don't have one. And now they don't know how to get to where they're headed either, and they're going to have to ask directions. What do you think that's going to be like? And I think that's a really good indication of the kind of thing that we mean, right? When we talk about white privilege in this instance, I was able to think to myself, well, I can just go up and ask directions. It's not going to be a problem. The odds are really good. They're not going to meet me at the door with a shotgun, let alone shoot at me like this guy in Michigan just did with this young black kid asking directions to get to his school. But if in Idaho in 2003, if that had been a black speaker, would that person have been as willing to go up to someone's door? And if they did, would they have been met likely with the same kind of equanimity and politeness and friendliness that I likely would have? Now, don't get me wrong. I don't want to castigate or cast aspersions upon the fine people of the eastern Washington and western Idaho geographic region. There are some fine folks up there. And the odds are that most people upon whose door a black MLK Day speaker would have knocked, probably would have treated them fine and wouldn't have shot at them. I'm not saying that it would have automatically led to death or some tragedy. But what I am saying is that there's no way that a black person in that same position that I was in would have been able to take for granted that everything was going to go okay. It probably would have gone okay, but they could not have taken that for granted. They could not have assumed that it was going to be all right for them to go up and knock on someone's door. Because, as this young man in Michigan just learned, when you are black in America, there is a certain degree to which white Americans, many of us, not all but many, have simply decided that you don't belong here. And here means wherever we are, right? It means our neighborhood. It means our place of work. It means our school or the school that our children attend. It means our college, right? This notion of belonging and non-belonging, which played out in that Starbucks in Philadelphia, which played out in that front yard of that home in Michigan when that young boy gets shot at by the homeowner, which played out recently at a LA Fitness. You probably saw this story as well. Two black guys, one of whom was a member of an LA Fitness and the other was his guest, were asked to leave because they supposedly hadn't paid. Well, they were members. Or the one guy was a member and they had paid for a guest pass and they still asked them to leave. Or there was a story just yesterday of two black women playing golf, or I think two or three women playing golf at a golf club in York, Pennsylvania, to which they belong as members. And the police were called on them by some white golfers, one of whom I think is the father of the owner, the young man who owns the place, I think it was his dad, who was playing golf behind these women, said they were playing too slow, called the police. It's this persistent thing whereby people of color are simply presumed not to really belong here or to only belong to the extent they have been asked explicitly in and invited and they serve at our pleasure, that they are only allowed so long as we allow them, that it is a guest pass. This, for African Americans who have been on this soil, that we now call the United States for longer, I beg to remind you, than damn near any European, probably more than any European, because there were Africans who were shipwrecked in a Spanish fleet off the coast of South Carolina in the late 1500s before Jamestown. So before your English or your Irish or your Italian or your German or your Dutch or whatever the hell ancestors got here, and before mine did, they were here. And yet we want to act as if they are on a guest pass in our house, in our club. This isn't our club. It's never been our club. But it is the fundamental conceit of whiteness and white supremacy that makes it seem as though it is. And this is one of the reasons we better get clear on this issue of white nationalism. We like to think of white nationalism as just what those boys in Charlottesville last year were clamoring for when they were demanding a white ethno-state, right? The racial purging, the ethnic cleansing of the land. And we cluck our tongues and we point our fingers at them and we say to ourselves how terrible that is. But do you realize what these incidents I've talked about today indicate? What the Starbucks incident and the LA Fitness incident and the incident with the kid in Rochester getting shot and these women at the golf club and so many others that we could talk about. All the backlash against affirmative action when white folks decide to sue their schools because they got bumped by a black person and then come to find out, no, actually the black folks were more qualified than you and there were all these white folks who got in ahead of you who had lower test scores, but you didn't complain about that. That's like Abigail Fisher, the University of Texas. And there were all these white folks who got in ahead of her who were less qualified, but she didn't complain. Why? Because those white folks belong at the University of Texas in the mind of Abigail Fisher, and the black and brown folks didn't. What do all these incidents have in common? They all have in common the idea that this is indeed a white nation, that this is indeed a white college, that this is indeed a white neighborhood, that this is indeed a white golf club, or whatever the case might be. That's white nationalism. It may not be the kind that marches around with tiki torches and wears swastikas and burns crosses and yells white power, but it operationalizes white power and white supremacy every day, and it does it right under our noses, and no one says anything the way they do, or at least they don't say nearly as much as they do, when those folks in Charlottesville make it obvious and when it's blatant, right? When it's subtle like that, when it's every day, when it's the kind of stuff that we've all had instilled in us, oh, we might get upset, but we don't call it white nationalism. White nationalism is baked into the foundations of white cultural and political behavior and thought in this country. So the problem is not Nazis. The problem is us and the country that has been created that we continue to countenance and do far too little to change. I'll be back with my conversation with Manifa Bendele in just a second. Well, thank you, first of all, so much, Manifa, for joining me on the program. It's great to talk with you. Haven't seen you in a couple of years. So for those who aren't familiar with your work and the work that you do at Moms Rising, why don't we just start by talking a little bit about that? What are some of the things that you're working on and that the organization is working on, particularly as it relates to this important issue of maternal health and particularly maternal health disparities in this country?
So Moms Rising is a national organization, and we work on a whole host of issues that impact women in the workplace and women in the community. Our wheelhouse issues that we started working on a decade ago really had to do with like access to paid leave, which, you know, the United States is the only country in the developed world that doesn't have legally a paid opportunity for mothers and fathers to stay home once they have children. So paid family leave is a big issue. Equal pay, paid sick days, all of those things that really kind of create the disparities between women and men in the workplace. Mm-hmm. And as we know, women of color, those disparities are even greater. But more recently, we've been working across a whole host of issues that impact mothers really even outside of the workplace, even though they're connected. We've worked on access to healthcare. We work on sentencing reform and ending mass incarceration. We work on deconstructing the school-to-prison pipeline. And we have had a very specific focus on maternal justice. Again, the United States is the only country in the developed world where maternal mortality is on the rise, meaning that women are dying due to complications based on their pregnancies or labor and delivery at rates that are higher than other places in the world. And what we find is what's really driving that rate is the huge disparity between Black and white women in the United States. So right now, Black women are 4 times more likely to die during childbirth than white women. That's nationally. But then when you zero in on places like New York, that rate goes up to 12 times more likely. And in DC, it gets even bigger. So we have a maternal mortality crisis that basically mostly exists within the Black community. You know, Black mothers are at the greatest risk, so much so that it's driving up the national rate as it compares to other countries.
And you know, what's interesting about that and really disturbing about the data that you just shared, I know that when we talk about health disparities, whether we're talking about maternal health or just in general, the racial disparities in health outcomes, it could be looking at infant mortality, it could be looking at disease etiology later on in life, that there's an assumption on the part of a lot of people, including, I think, a lot of liberal and progressive folks who are horrified by those disparities, but they make the assumption that the thing that drives that, well, it's, you know, it's economics. Well, mm-hmm. these Black women just don't have access to good enough healthcare. So as long as we can get better healthcare reform, whether that's ACA or whether that's universal coverage mm-hmm. or whatever it is, like if we can just fix the economic piece, they think, then that's going to take care of the racial piece. But I gather from the research that that is really wrong. So tell us why that's wrong and how wrong it is.
And I think it's shocking for even the scientists that have been sharing this data recently, which is that when you look at other groups of women, if you look at white women, the probability of them having these complications that include, you know, death or serious illness during birth and delivery is tied to their access to health care, their income level, their education level. So there's like this poverty and there is a education level impact on their health outcomes. But when you look at maternal mortality for Black women, that disappears. Black women are more likely to die during birth and delivery, whether they're in a higher socioeconomic status, whether they have high level of education, as much as if they have a low level of education or they are work for very low wages. And so it kind of blows that whole theory out of the water. In fact, right now in New York, a Black woman who has a college education is more likely to die during childbirth than a white woman who only has a high school diploma. So the disparity is there, but even just when you look at Black women, you don't see the line going up or down based on class or based on education right. that you see with other groups of women. So that only leaves you, so when you cross out those two things, that only leaves you with one thing, which yeah. is race. And that's the consistent factor with what's happening in these deaths. Now, what I love to point out anecdotally is that Serena Williams shared her birthing story in a post just this past December. And people were shocked and mortified about how Serena Williams almost died after she gave birth. And she basically had to go get out of bed and demand to have her life saved. Mm-hmm. You know, she was on the verge of having a pulmonary aneurysm, which is deadly. And so she happened to be, you know, the greatest athlete of all time. Here's a very wealthy woman. She's probably one of the most wealthiest women in the country. Luckily, she was conscious after delivery. I know after I had my kids, I wasn't even conscious, so I couldn't have advocated the way she did. And she had the wherewithal to say, no, give me a CT scan right now. Damn it. Right. That able to save her life. So, you know, and people look like, oh my God, but that is the day-to-day lived experience of Black women when we interact with the healthcare delivery system, is that we are invisible, our pain is ignored. There's assumed that we can endure greater levels of pain. The woman who is the chief editor of The Root, Kirsten West Savali, she posted the other day that she had been in the ER. She was sick and she was being discharged. And the nurse, as a means for complimenting her, was like, oh, you're so good. You're so strong, right? Yeah. She's like, okay, thank you. Yeah. And so then she goes further. This is like all on her Facebook page. She's like, you know who are the strongest babies in the neonatal unit? Now she's talking about babies. Yeah. She's like, oh, She's black girls. And so she's like, how are these black girls that like strong? Like, what do you mean? Like, and you know, she goes into this whole thing and she has to like stop her and say, this is what's leading to like the death of like black women.
Right.
But the woman is actually like saying this as a compliment. This is right. a nurse. This is a right. healthcare professional
right.
who's telling her that somehow, you know, in the neonatal unit, which is where kids are really
struggling
vulnerable,
to stay alive.
They're very vulnerable.
Yeah.
That she has the impression that the black girls are less vulnerable. How and she's saying it like a compliment. I mean, it's just all kinds of bullshit.
Yeah, yeah. Well, absolutely. I mean, the thing about Serena Williams that was so powerful and distressing was she is probably, at least on a overt and explicit level, respected by whoever was providing her care as an athlete, you know, as a superstar. And yet, there seemed to be something going on that got in the way, even with, you know, I'm going to assume, and I mean, I could be wrong. She could have, you know, had doctors that were blatantly racist, but I'm going to assume that the scarier thing is that they weren't, that the scarier thing is that they probably aren't overt vicious bigots. And yet there was something about the way that they interact with black women, which, you know, wasn't changed just by her superstar status and by her finances. What are some of the things you sort of alluded to them there when you talked about the assumption regarding pain management? What are some of the biases that even well-intended, non-bigoted, non-overtly racist healthcare providers may be carrying around with them that get in the way of providing equitable care?
You know, there's this myth out there that black women's bodies can withstand more pain or that black women don't feel pain. And when we say that to people, they're like, oh, that just must be ignorant people. But there was actually recently a Harvard study where they surveyed doctors and medical students and found that a substantial number of them actually believed that black people don't experience pain as much and that black women don't experience pain to the extent that white women do. And so these are people who are doctors and people who are studying to become doctors. This myth of the black superwoman, you know, that we're just so resilient and that we've survived all these things, so that there must be something supernatural that's happening within our bodies, you know. And the fact of the matter is a lot of times we're not surviving.
Right.
We're actually dying at greater rates from everything, even things that we get less often, like breast cancer. Like right now, breast cancer is more likely to occur in white women, but black women are more likely to die from breast cancer. So like even the stuff, you know, a lot of stuff we get it more often, like high blood pressure, heart disease.
Yeah.
But even with the stuff that we don't, we die more often.
Yeah. Well, what's always astounded me about that notion of black women as these, you know, superhuman folks who can endure anything and be resilient in the face of all obstacles, you know, if we really believe that as a society, then why don't we have black women in charge of everything? Like at that point, if black
right.
women are really superhuman and we actually really believe that, then we ought to be putting black women in charge of every single institution because they'll just take whatever shit's thrown at them. But we don't. So I believe it probably is the case that we don't really think that black women have these amazing capabilities, but we just don't care at some level. There's an indifference to their pain. It's not that we really believe that they are superior in some way, because the whole concept of white supremacy suggests that we think that black folks are inferior.
It's like two sides of the same coin. The idea that you have superhuman strength, like physicality, actually is dehumanizing. Actually is rendering, it's actually stripping away your humanity and putting black people in the categories of other species that people think of as being stronger than humans. So it's kind of like this doublespeak when they talk about like this black superwoman, because it's actually a dehumanizing thing that's going on. It's saying that actually we're stripping away your humanity, your ability to feel or to be afraid or to be vulnerable. And we're stripping away all of that, which are very much, you know, human qualities.
Yeah, so it is this weird, perverse form of white supremacy in that regard. And it sort of reminds me of, I mean, just thinking back to some recent events, sort of like saying that Mike Brown was running through bullets with superhuman capabilities, like, you know, bullets can't stop him the way they can other people. I mean, it's all part of the same thing. It's dehumanizing either as inferior or strangely superior, but never really just human. So for these folks who were doctors, I mean, here's what's fascinating. We think of physicians as, you know, obviously, at least on one level, among the most highly educated of all people. So, you know, they understand things like disease etiology and formation. They understand, at least theoretically, the way pain receptors work within the human body. They understand how pharmacologically certain things can block pain receptors. And yet, here we have these incredibly highly educated, highly skilled people who are no less susceptible to the implicit racial biases of that person sitting in a bar, you know, pontificating. How is it that doctors and nurses and care providers can go through all of this schooling and never, ever have to sort of confront and analyze some of their own biases? I mean, I guess it's not in the curriculum. I guess they're not being trained. What's the problem there?
Yeah, so if we're not intentional about addressing health inequities, if we're not intentional about deconstructing people's racial bias, unconscious bias, explicit bias, implicit bias, then it will remain, you know. And so there has to actually be inserted into the education of healthcare providers a way of stripping away these biases. Because you, by the time you go to medical school, right, you're 22 years old. So you're an adult. So you've lived for, you know, more than two decades completely drenched in white supremacy, whether you're conscious of it or not. Those types of things don't just go away because of some stats and figures on a board, right? Yeah. So as people move through, and this is with that, whatever field people are going into, we really need to have critical race analysis woven throughout our education system, or people will carry with them their white supremacist unconscious bias throughout everything they do, whether they're practicing law, if they're teachers. You know, teachers are more likely to suspend Black children than other children for the same offenses. You know, why is that? And when they interviewed teachers there, you know, when they really delved into the psychology of it, they gave Black children more responsibility, a sense more of a maturity than other children. So other children are allowed to be children, to be vulnerable, yeah, to kind of be weak. But for some reason, you know, that five-year-old Black boy, he should know better. And so, you know, all of these things come about because there's like a lifetime of racism that we all are just drenched in. And then by the time you get to your professional life, doctors are no different from anyone else. You know, they're gonna fall back on these values. So, you know, there has to be training, but it can't just be training. There has to be real accountability throughout the healthcare system to bring these numbers down. Yeah. Because that works too. If hospitals are held accountable, like Black women need to stop dying when they come right here, then they will figure out protocols that will make that not happen anymore. So there's kind of like a both and that needs to happen.
Yeah, it seems like the training thing, which everybody is quick to jump on as if somehow, you know, it's like with Starbucks now, right? I mean, they're going to do this training, and yet you've got to have some type of actual mechanism that will allow you to see if you're actually making progress. And if you don't, if you just do the training and no checklist of things that you're looking for to guarantee progress, you're not likely to get there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the thing we say all the time with police reform. You know, they want to train the hell out of the police. Mm-hmm. And we're like, how about this? Why don't you stop killing Black people?
Right. You know? Right.
Like, can we do that?
Right.
Like, training is fine.
Right.
You know, and you understanding yourself and getting closer to what your motivations and fears are. Hey, that's great. I need that too.
Right.
You know, but like you said, until people have some real metrics that they have to stick to, some real declines that they need to show.
Right.
Then I don't care about training. That doesn't help me that you're trained.
Right. I mean, and in any other field, like if your job was not a doctor, but if your job were to design tennis shoes and you designed a tennis shoe that nobody bought, you would lose your job and you wouldn't be able to go back and go, well, that's a damn good shoe. I don't know what's wrong with these people. They won't buy it. You would lose your job because the metric would be success based on sales. Well, when you're talking about doctors, it seems like the metric is how many patients you lose in, how many folks are dying, how many people are remaining ill. Same thing with teaching, right? How many, you know, if you've got persistent gaps in outcomes, then it's either, there are only two options, either it's the kids or it's you. And as we just noted, obviously in the case of maternal health and even the school discipline issue, the data says, you know, upper middle class and affluent Black kids get suspended and expelled even more often than poor white kids who might be dealing with real economic marginality and some of the stuff that comes with that. So it isn't just about class and it's not even about behavior, because we know the data actually says the rates of infractions are roughly the same across racial lines. And yet people of color being disproportionately suspended. And I'm sure that when it comes to maternal health and health disparities, this is what folks will say, right? So what folks say, they say, well, the other thing that might explain these health disparities, other than economics and other than racial discrimination, is, you know, Black folks have they make different lifestyle choices, right? This is the bullshit that people say, right? So they'll talk about diet and they'll talk about exercise and they'll talk about, you know, all of these things, anything they can grasp onto that will allow the society to maintain its sense of racial innocence. Now, I've certainly seen some data with regard to infant mortality, for instance, that says, hey, you know, even Black women who don't smoke cigarettes and never have smoked cigarettes have higher infant mortality rates than white women that smoke a pack and a half a day. So it can't be that when it comes to infant mortality. I haven't really looked at the data, though, on other health outcomes or maternal health for the women in question. Have you looked at any of that? And how do we know that those lifestyle arguments are bunk?
One of the big policy levers that we're working on right now is actually data collection. Right now, the states are collecting their data in different ways. What constitutes maternal mortality in one state may not in another. So when you die, when a mother dies, either while she's pregnant or during the delivery or after, sometimes her death may be attributed to what she died from.
Oh, yeah.
She had a stroke, right? So maybe just say, you know, it may not show up in the data that she had a stroke after she gave birth, or she had a heart attack after, you know, maybe like heart attack, you know, it won't be maternal mortality. So that's one thing. One thing is that this is really kind of like a new issue area. It's not a new issue area, like it's been happening, but it's coming on the radar, and advocates are really scrambling to get all kinds of research done about like, so we see the economic piece. We know that, okay, it doesn't matter if you're like Serena Williams, you know, or you are me. There's a big gap. You're at risk for this happening to you. But also, I think just as far as like, are Black women more likely to have high blood pressure? Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, but even that, is that based on lifestyle or is it the toxic stress of being a Black woman in America?
Right.
You know, like we have to get more research done to make the case, but we know, but Black women know,
right?
So you like, okay, like Serena Williams, she's healthy, goddammit. So, you know, we uplift these stories to say that the fact that you're ignored or made to feel invisible or thought to not, you know, or you're thought to not feel to feel pain has nothing to do with your lifestyle choices. Right. And so we have to kind of get out of our heads that, you know, Black women are walking around just drinking quarter waters and, you know, not taking their prenatal vitamins. And I know what you're saying, because I know that those are the things swimming around in people's heads.
Right.
But it's just actually like not the case. It's like the myth of Black women having a whole lot of babies. It's not true. There's this like mythology that's going on in people's heads about Black people and the black children and the black women, just like with the school to prison pipeline, that, you know, Black kids are just, they're acting up more, you know, they're more likely to like curse at the teacher, and this is just not true. So we need to get that data, but at the same time we don't need to get it, you know, because like this, it's almost like a rabbit hole.
Well, that's just it. I mean, and we also know that when it comes to pushing the needle forward on policy and real change, that facts and data, even when they're totally on our side, aren't really what get it done, right? It's really those narratives. It's those stories, whether it's Serena Williams or just someone down the block, being able to tell their story about the way that they were treated. I mean, the weird thing about this Starbucks incident, for instance, or any other incident of individual microaggression, macroaggression, implicit or explicit bias, that stuff, even though the problem is much deeper than that, even though the problem is much more structural than that, and even though the data has said Black folks are treated like that all the time, people will not believe it until they have a story to attach to and a face. And even then, sometimes they won't. Right. There are even now people who are trying to say, well, something must have happened in that Starbucks, you know, and of course.
Right. And I'm in a position of like, that is secondary. Like,
right.
We need the stories. We need to transform people's hearts and minds. But we also just need to put people in the positions of power. We need to build power in a way in Black communities that don't allow these things to happen.
Right.
So it's like, no matter. So even if you do think that the cops should be called on someone because they asked to use the bathroom and then sat down to wait for their friend, that the system is not in place that would allow you to do that. The laws are not written in a way that would allow you to do that. So you could be having a whole huff in your whole head. You know, the whole thing about, you know, white supremacy is like, privilege, power, you know, alongside these concepts that that are resulting in death. So yeah, it's a both and, but I always take it back to the accountability piece. Mechanisms in place to say, if these are the rates at your hospital, you will suffer the consequences. You must fix it.
Right.
So whether you care about Black women who come, you know, or you just actually care about your metrics for your hospital.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, this is the basis upon which you will be judged and either rewarded or punished, as the case may be, because, you know, federal funds flow to hospitals, right? And state funds flow to hospitals. And there's always a possibility of withholding those if the motivation is there. Now, how do we, I guess that then begs the question, you know, how do we build movement around, like you said, this is an issue that's been around a long time and a problem that has certainly been around a long time. Some of the awareness around the data and learning about it may be, you know, a little bit behind the curve. How do we build movement around that and connect it to this broader range of issues so that this gets on people's radar at the front of their brains rather than in the back of their brains? What are some strategic methods or mechanisms that you all are trying to deploy at the local or state or federal level to build power and capacity to take away, as you said, the option of acting on these biases? Are there any particular ways of doing that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that we're doing is like a lot of civic engagement and candidate recruitment training, really centering women of color. Just last year, we did a boot camp on data and civic engagement training because we have to build power among Black women. And we see already, just from the last 2 years, record numbers of Black women are running for office all over the country. I mean, I don't know if you've seen it. Like, and there's something about judges. There's like all of these judgeships that all throughout the South, Black women have thrown their hats in the ring to run for these positions. And as communities and as organizations, we have to provide the structures to not only encourage, but to help foster that pipeline so that Black women can get into positions of power and say, you know, not only do hospitals need to follow these metrics for these protocols, because we have Black women in our state legislature that are pissed about this stat, but we also have people in the judiciary who are saying, and you know what, quite frankly, it's malpractice if, you know, Black women are dying when they're saying, you know, I can feel that my lung is collapsing, and you're like, oh, go lay down, you know.
So
these types of getting into these positions of power have to do with us all trusting Black women, getting behind Black-led organizing, especially the big organizations. You know, Moms Rising is a big organization. You know, there are a lot of your big national organizations, civil rights organizations, that typically operate in a way that they're like sucking all the air out of the room when it comes to figuring out how to solve these issues. So last week, Moms Rising got behind an organization called Black Mamas Matter Alliance. They did a Black Maternal Health Week, and they put out toolkits. We did tweet chats. They did a Facebook Live, and they led the way. The national groups got behind a lot of Black women-led organizations in places like North Carolina and Georgia, groups like Sister Song, and were able to really push out these stories and hold policymakers accountable to figuring out some type of state policies to shift the tide. I think if we have more of that, like if people who are closest to the problem are centered in the leadership of solving those problems, and that's no matter what the issues are, then the results you will see will be more impactful. They'll be more long term. They'll be able to hold on to those results and have accountability to the policies that are put in place. So that's really, I think I can't underscore that enough, that we need to build power amongst Black women it as a means to turning back this negative tide in Black women's maternal health.
Right. Well, and you know, this makes me think of something too. And you mentioned Sister Song a second ago, and it reminded me of a conversation that I had about 6 weeks or 7 weeks ago with Loretta Ross, who of course was one of the first principals of Sister Song. And we were talking about the way in which when we talk about maternal health, or even just the notion of maternity, both on the right and even on the white left, there seems to be this tendency to frame all of these issues, like around the issue of reproductive freedom and reproductive choice, as an issue of, you know, on the right, obviously to them, being pro-life means, you know, stopping abortion access. It doesn't apparently mean guaranteeing that women who choose to have children, particularly Black women who choose to have children, will be able to have them in a healthy way, raise them in a healthy way, and themselves remain healthy in the aftermath of the birth. And then even on the white left, within certain elements of white feminism and the white part of the women's movement, there has been this tendency to also frame these issues as you know, that the focus is on preserving the right of women not to have children. And of course, that is incredibly important, and I'm not trying to diminish that at all. But it seems as if there hasn't always been as much of a focus on, when you think of pro-choice, right, also the choice of having children and having them be healthy, that that has somehow been secondary to both the pro-life movement for its own pernicious reasons, but even the reproductive freedom movement among the white left. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why reproductive justice has emerged. Yeah. And Sister Song has been one of those central organizations who have led that and said that, you know, this is not just about choice. You know, this is about reproductive justice. This is about women not only being able to have their babies when they want to have their babies, but those babies surviving and those women surviving and thriving. So reproductive justice touches on everything. You know, this police brutality, yeah, the school to prison pipeline. You know, it's one thing to just have survived,
right,
you know, but to thrive is a whole nother issue. And so you find that especially when you have women of color and Black women, especially in these conversations, you know, it could, we're the ones that can pull it from being such a tone deaf conversation. Yeah. Around choice. You know, Black women want choice too, but you're not going to, with so much else going on, like, okay, yeah, I can give birth to my baby, but are they going to get shot down in the street,
right,
on their way to school?
Right.
You know, will they be arrested and handcuffed? Will I be able to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables when I'm raising my kid? Yeah. So you kind of have to have a more holistic approach to what it really means to be a mother when you're talking to Black women. And that's why it's so important for these organizations to be central.
Absolutely. Well, one more thing, and it's sort of going backwards a little bit, but it, I can make it all tie together because it certainly speaks to the historical way in which Black women's bodies and lives have always been sacrificed and their pain and their suffering ignored by white folks in positions of authority. So this last week, I guess it was, sort of an important symbolic, if nothing else, but maybe more than symbolic, thing happened in New York City. The statue that had been erected in 1894 in Central Park for J. Marion Sims, who was, I guess, considered the father of gynecology, which the whole term father of gynecology sort of it leaves me a little cold. I have a feeling there were women doing obstetrics and gynecology for a long, long time before he came along or any other guy came along. But in any event, here's a guy who has a statue erected to him in New York City in 1894, and that statue remained up and has remained up until this last week. It was recently removed, and there had been a movement to have it removed for a bit now. Talk a little bit about why that was important from a symbolic or greater perspective, and let folks know a little bit if they don't know about J. Marion Sims and what he represents, particularly to Black women's health and bodily autonomy, because I think there's a pretty disturbing story there.
Yeah, absolutely. So I just want to touch on two things as it relates to J. Marion Sims. One piece that you touched on was so important. Like, how is someone the father, right, of gynecology? Black women, from the very first time Black women were brought from Africa to the shores of the United States, were midwives. You know, Black women were the ones delivering the babies, you know, all over the quote-unquote New World. And of course, before then, Native women were delivering the babies,
yeah,
and caring to and catering to women's maternal health needs. And what you see in history is that at some point, when the whole, you know, post the father of gynecology and the in this whole corporate medical structure, that midwifery became outlawed. So,
yeah,
you know, we can talk about that, and that's a whole another show. But as it relates to J. Marion Sims, yes. So he was a doctor, and you know, when I studied him, and when everyone used to learn about him in school, it was like, oh yeah, you know, he developed all of these modern tools that doctors use now to do things like examine women, to fix an issue where there's a tear in the vagina after giving birth, and all these things. It was just like, oh, this is so great. But what we didn't learn at that time was that this was all built on his torture of Black women. So now when you read the articles, it's like, oh, this is so terrible. Dr. Sims experimented on women. So I'm like, no, like I experiment with like hair color. You check out this, let me see how this purple looks. That's experimenting, right? Torture is a more appropriate term because one, you have people who did not have the ability to say no, right? So these African women who were enslaved, they were owned by others and they were either rented to him or owned by him. So automatically, there's no consent there to these procedures. And then secondly, there was no use of anesthesia because, again, this idea that Black women didn't need painkillers, right? Yeah. So that all that really that boils down to like torture, captive torture, right, is what he did in order to create these devices, which made him very popular and very wealthy and very renowned and his family and so on and so forth. So that throughout history, you've like uplifted someone who tortured women, who tortured Black women as a means to making a name for himself, as a means to, you know, making money for himself, is not something that we should be uplifting. And so last year, in fact, and I want to give a big shout out to a group, BYP 100, the Black Youth Project, did an action that was in coordination with a lot of people who had been wanting this statue removed, where young women went in surgical gowns and had like fake, you know, blood splattered on the front of the gowns to represent the women who were captive and who were tortured by this man. And they did a protest at the statue. And the activities really accelerated after that because these images went all over social media and people were like, well, what was that? And then people get to hear the story of what really happened to the women who were the mothers of modern day gynecology. And just last week, really on the last day of Black Women's Maternal Health Week, that statue was removed by the Parks Department and they took it on and moved it on over to his grave at Greenwood Cemetery where it belongs. And so that's, you know, and people think that it's symbolic, but it's really not. I mean, it speaks to the values, right? If there's a monument in the city, in Central Park, you've got to pay money to maintaining this. So there's a budget item. You know, there's all these things that speak to the values. And as we build power, there's actually a lot of Black women who are leaders in public health in New York City who are also championing that through the back channels. Are saying like, no, there's a new way forward. We need to champion these midwives. We need to bring back midwifery. Yeah. We need to bring back doulas. Doulas is not new. Doulas is what Black women were doing, you know, in Africa.
Right.
And we need to bring that back as a way to making sure that we are preserving Black maternal health. The removing of that statue is important because what they've also done is committed to creating some type of plaque for the women whose names we have.
Yeah.
And that's bringing back that humanity, being like these women's the humanity of these women was stripped away.
Right.
And so now we're going to restore that humanity by naming them what they went through and what they contributed to modern medicine, similar to Henrietta Lacks, to really shift the narrative about our place as Black women and our Black women's bodies in this whole narrative.
Well, how can folks who want to learn more about the work of Moms Rising and how they can get involved with some of that work, how can they reach out and connect to it? Because I know people are going to want to do that. So what are some resources, some places that they can connect with you and that they can figure out a way to get more involved?
Absolutely. You know, please definitely go to our website, momsrising.org, sign up, and you'll begin to get alerts and emails about the different actions we're doing on maternal mortality. Definitely check out the Black Mamas Matter Alliance. You can find them by searching them online. They have an amazing website with the toolkit and amazing fact sheets. Get in touch with Sister Song. Right now, they're doing an amazing tour in North Carolina, going from various counties, having listening sessions about maternal health, especially the practice of shackling, the shackling of pregnant women who are in jails, prisons, and detention centers, and trying to get North Carolina to end that practice. So, you know, there's so many amazing groups to touch base with. Sister Song, Black Mamas Matter Alliance, Moms Rising, if you want to get a lot of information on what's happening on the national level. There is a bill that we're supporting.
Okay.
It's called the Prevent Maternal Deaths Act. And we definitely want people to reach out to their representatives to make sure that they are co-sponsoring that bill. So many similar ones popping up on the state level. So if you plug into an organization, you can get involved.
That'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. Be sure to join us next Tuesday and every week for yet another show. And look for us on Facebook, Instagram, and Tumblr at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Podomatic, iTunes, Google Play, and of course, Patreon.com, where you can sign up to become a monthly sustainer of the show and receive extra bonus content unavailable anywhere else. For this episode, I'd like to thank Felicia Gustin, Jean Kayani, and Amalia Mesa Gustin at Speak Out, my producer, Jamie Lynn Moeller, and of course, Brother Ali, for giving permission to use his song, Gather Round, as the intro and outro music for the program. And that is where we're headed now. Till next time.